I was at an event this past week with a group of artists that I really enjoy and respect. Okay. So we've just been talking about being together. So can we just pause for a minute and just, I want to pause and savor this. Okay. I was, and a number of us from our family, we were at an event outdoors, live, in person, other people at the venue. People were vaccinated. We could wear masks or not as we chose. For a couple of hours, it felt pretty close to before times. You know, it really did. And that was really nice. And I've carried away a kind of bright ember of hope. It still feels like it's glowing, you know, a bit of warmth and comfort to have with me on the days where it can still feel pretty dark sometimes. Anyway. At the start of this event, this particular event, someone read out a land acknowledgement. And one of the reasons that I respect this group of artists and enjoy them is because they have consistently refused to go down paths in their live performances that could be disrespectful and demeaning of others, even when it was easy pickings in terms of entertainment and response from the crowd. And that's not a simple matter, given that this is an improvisational comedy troupe and improv is what they do. The land acknowledgement, though, at least on this occasion, sort of felt like somehow it missed that mark. And that could have been a tone thing, maybe it was an environment thing, maybe it was an I'm not quite feeling it thing. I mean, I don't know. I'm not in a position to know that. Maybe to me, at least, it was because that land acknowledgement was so scripted on a night where the unscripted nature of the art making was being lauded. That's what we responded to as a crowd, was when somebody spontaneously, or together, collaboratively, even more, spontaneously made something that clearly was about listening and attending to the other at a deep level. However, why ever it happened this way for me, it felt like a miss for me, and my spirit kind of hasn't quite shaken that off. This land, this physical place where we live and we move and we have our being, it's got history, and that history informs the present in ways that are wonderful, that are terrible, that are mundane, sometimes all at once, right? All blended together. As a species, as humans, we can get used to and we can normalize many things, including systemic inequality and injustice. And at least from my vantage point, it's only by constant effort that we keep those things in view, because they are uncomfortable. They don't tilt toward order, for sure not in the near term. This moment when we gather, this moment where every week I say something about the land that we're on and how one of its core identities is that of being Treaty One territory, that's partly how I hold myself accountable to not forget about these things. Now, if you don't need that reminder, then don't pick it up. It's not for you. If you do need it, or you have it handy already in some other way, then I'm glad for the company in carrying a front of mind awareness of this part of reality and being consciously grateful to be made welcome right here, right now. It's good. To my Indigenous First Peoples and First Nations kinfolk, thank you. And I would say similarly with taking time to breathe together. Someone in our community reminded me this week that for folks that have experienced trauma, being invited to close your eyes and be still might be completely undoable. It might even trigger that trauma again. It might be re-traumatizing in some ways. And personally, I feel privileged to have very few of the kind of experiences in my life that would lead me to know about that experience from the inside. However, as with remembering that I'm a guest on First Nations land, that good fortune, if you will, in my life can easily mean that I move through life ignorant of how challenging this part of our gatherings can be for other people. So, as always, an invitation without obligation to take this up if it's life-giving for you, and to set it aside without guilt or reservation of any kind if it's not. If breathing quietly, alone with your interior self, does not feel like a gift to you at this point, then probably it isn't. And trying to force it is only going to backfire, so don't do it. But if it does feel like a welcoming thing, even if it feels new or unusual, then I would encourage you to join in. And what we're going to do together this morning, or what I'm going to invite you to be a part of this morning with me, is just to be, for a few moments, just to be calm. And if you are somewhere where you can see or touch or smell or perhaps taste something that feels like it's of the earth, then I would encourage you to have that orientation, whether it's looking out a window, whether you're if you're outside on this gorgeous morning, even better. If you can touch the physical earth, that's lovely. But just that connection to what we sometimes call nature. Make that connection and just be still with that connection and breathe for a few moments. And I'll let us know when we're moving on to what's next. All right, but let's just take a few moments to breathe together. If you're listening to this on the podcast after the fact, I won't leave very much space in the podcast for this. Just hit pause and take as much time as you wish or can take. And then we'll carry on together. All right. So let's just breathe and be calm and be conscious of the earth, our home, and that which gives us life. All right. Let's be together. Tim Penner, if you're listening in, your comments about fall, about autumn, come to mind as I look out the window of the space that I'm in here at the changing leaf colors and leaves actually drifting down through my field of view. While I was paying attention, and our yard, which of course gets covered in them, and thinking of that intersection of beauty and sadness, which we're not going to explore in any direct or deliberate way this morning, but it's a fascinating intersection, isn't it? And really connects to sort of the Ecclesiastes space that you, Tim Penner, were in this morning with the Harrison tune. Yeah, things pass, as do we. And one of the drives that seems to stir in us as human beings is toward the exploration of something that we can think of as permanent or eternal or ongoing, that we will touch on this morning. All right, so we are on the cusp of stage four in this particular schema for doubt and faith and exploration of those things that we've been working our way through. And we are far enough into this to have begun sort of having some interesting conversations with one another. They came up in the comments last week, for instance, about how the stages don't feel all that precise. As we've collected up more ways of thinking about our own experiences, we've started to identify the fact that all of these kind of overlap, or they flow in and out of these different identifiable experiences and perspectives. Getting to that point in a process like this is really good news for the process and for our experience of it. Because that's a really important perspective on the whole exercise, maybe especially as we approach stage four, which is in this particular schema, the final stage. And it could feel like a destination or a desired end, like we've been working toward, you know, the end. maybe it's just the desired end because, you know, you've had it with the whole series. I mean, we're now in double digits of the sequence, which is, in our context, dare I say it, unprecedented. But that's not what I meant. What I meant was that most of us have been taught in myriad ways that progress is linear, that the way up or the way forward is a series of sequential steps. We can demarcate them, we can measure them, we can check off the boxes, you know? That's how it works with so many things, and not the least of which is the thing we might call education, right? Where the dominant system in which we are so formed, if we grew up in this culture for so many years, This is one of sort of accumulating layers of accomplishment or certification, or checking off the box of previous and moving to next. So like elementary, junior high school, undergrad, graduate, doctorate, postgraduate, or postdoctoral work, death. I mean, I don't know what comes after postdoctoral work. Tim, help me out. I'm not educated enough to know what follows that. The point is that we're used to that approach. And so it can be hard to remember that sometimes we can have lots of, book learning, but still not be very wise. That education, as with any other kind of learning, can be a pretty complex, interwoven sort of thing where the lessons we might most need to learn can come at unpredictable times and in unpredictable ways, and in ways that don't necessarily match some tidy scheme, some outline. Life is messy. We're messy. So our learning and our growing is messy. When I was in my 20s, I once had occasion to spend a month, a continuous month in this particular case, climbing in the Selkirk Mountain Range in interior BC. And it was winter when we did all this, and we were above the tree line almost the entire time. So camping was a little different than it is, if you go to the Whiteshell in July. Everything we needed had to be packed in, had to be carried up from the valley to a place above this little lake below a glacial moraine where we had established a base camp, and we ferried big loads up to that camp for several days. But then we kind of settled in and we went out day by day on different explorations in that part of the range, things we could get to and back on foot or with skis in a day. So whatever stage we identify with in this exploration we've been doing here, this stages of exploration, whatever stage we identify with in a given point is kind of like our base camp. It's the place we presently have the most comfort, where we can access the most resources, but we can come and go from it, and we can venture back down for more of what we need for a particular circumstance. We can venture up to explore things that are still unknown or unexplored by us. The stage we're in is kind of like our base camp. Now, to press the metaphor a little bit, base camp is also movable. Not as easily as we can just sort of duck out of a base camp and explore new terrain, but if the reasons are compelling. So, for example, if we're in this instance that the story I'm telling, if we were camped somewhere where the snow accumulated, and it really did in feet at a time, sometimes if enough snow had accumulated on a certain slope above our base camp, we would have wanted to move it because we were in danger of an avalanche where we weren't before. So, circumstances can compel us to do the work of moving base camp. Our experiences can compel it. And relocating our base camp means we now have easier access to some other new terrain. We have less easy access to other places, but we can still go in any direction from there. Maybe it's a bit like you don't have to identify with this if you don't want to. Maybe it's a bit like getting older. Poet and novelist Madeleine L'Engle once said, "The great thing about getting older is that you don't lose all the other ages that you've been." The great thing about getting older is that you don't lose all the other ages that you've been. Yeah. So here I am telling a story about my 20s, and it's still a part of me in some ways, right? The stages of this schema that we've been exploring, they're both cumulative. They add up, one follows the other, and they're iterative. There really isn't a top or a bottom, a best or a worst. Each one of these stages both includes the previous stage and also transcends it. So let me just unfold that a little bit. When we leave things behind as we move through stages of understanding what we believe and experiencing it in different ways, as we leave things behind in that process, we can think of that as the transcends part. And when we carry some things forward with us into a new stage, something we've learned in a previous stage, that's the includes part. So both transcends and includes, both cumulative and iterative. And when we move into or explore a new stage, we get to keep what we've learned in the previous stages. We get to choose about what we keep from what we've learned in the previous stages and what we've become there, how we've grown, how we've developed, the very things that led us into doubt sometimes, right? Here's another way to think about it. Once we've been in any of the stages for a while, whatever stage we're in can start to feel like our new simplicity stage, our new the way it is stage, right? But then we might experience some deeper complexity that might come up from within whatever stage we're in. And then we'll need to work through that complexity to get to perplexity, to get to, so simplicity, complexity, perplexity, and then what? We haven't really talked about that yet, have we? What are the outlines of stage four anyway? As we will outline it the way we've outlined the other ones, but we're actually not going to get to that today. And the reason, we will get to it soon though, the reason is that I want to introduce what I think is a very important complementary framework for the exploration of stage four. Maybe more correctly, this is an idea that I think might be big enough to background the kinds of exploration we tend to do in stage four, to sort of provide a space in which we can explore the features of that stage with purpose and without fear, both very important. Now, for an idea to do that kind of work, and I'm sort of hinting at something that I haven't described yet, but for an idea to do that kind of work, it needs to be pretty big because the exploration in stage four is quite generous, quite embracing. And so if we're going to background it, or we're going to frame it or contain it or support it in some way with another idea, that idea needs to be bigger. I don't have great words for this, but I'm going to do my best. That idea needs to be bigger than anything we can make. It needs to be bigger than any ideology or philosophy or religion that we can put together as human beings. And the reason I would say that is because it seems so obvious that although the ideas we make, the structures we make, the beliefs we come up with, even though they are very powerful and very important, they matter a great deal, they all suffer from a common problem. And the problem is that they can be turned into very unhealthy, even deadly forms. Again, Tim, it felt like you were reading my notes. Or my mind, maybe. When you talked about how, you know, like the thing that's lauded today is despised tomorrow, that the things pass away, right? That the things we make, the ideologies, the cultures, the subcultures that we make, have this temporariness about them that we have about ourselves, that we are. So I'm looking for something bigger than that. It would be nice to think that religion is exempt from this problem of turning beliefs into unhealthy or even deadly forms, but we can all see, without even trying, in fact, I think we'd have to try to not see this, we can all see that that isn't the case. Religion is not exempt. I mean, if the horror of residential schools somehow still feels too distant to get our attention in this regard, then we can always just start with the daily news, because if we look at that news, we will see their increasingly violent expressions of division in our own backyard, often rooted in religious ideology and rhetoric. There's an interesting thing, an interesting shift happening in our cultures at this stage, at this moment in history. I think it feels a bit new to us here in North America. It's not that new. But our experiences of it, maybe because we've been part of, for quite a long time in this part of the world, there has been a dominant culture, certainly not been the only culture. I mean, again, the indigenous story reminds us of this over and over again, but there has been a dominant, a prevailing culture that's been so ubiquitous, so found everywhere, that it's easy to believe that it's just normal, and we stop thinking about it. Let me unpack that this way. In the transcript of this is a 2018 NPR interview, there was a defector that was being interviewed, a defector from a hateful white supremacist movement that he had left. And the interviewer asked him why anyone would join a movement like that, like the one that he had once helped to lead. And he answered with three words. See if any of these feel familiar from your own religious experiences, perhaps, in particular. His answer was that the reason he would, or why anyone would join a movement like the one that he had left, was because of meaning, belonging, and purpose. Meaning, belonging, and purpose. That's one way to access or think about or speak about that common problem that I mentioned, the problem that whatever we believe or the beliefs that we make can be turned into unhealthy things, can be turned into even into deadly things. If we being humans, if we don't find those things, meaning, belonging, and purpose in healthy forms of spirituality, we seem to be so driven to find them that we will look for them in unhealthy forms. And partly, I think it's fair to say that to not look for those things is to give up, is to experience the thing we would use a word like despair for. And that's part of the problem as well, because people who've given up on this quest are uniquely vulnerable to being herded, to being compelled to buy almost anything that will blunt despair, including self-serving ideologies about things like economics or what constitutes value, the kinds of to consuming without considering how the thing that we're consuming might only be possible for us to have if someone else is being taken advantage of, those kinds of things. I want to read you an extended quote from a writer named Tara Isabella Burton. This is from an article that Tara Burton wrote in a 2019 publication of the New York Times. And Burton is speaking in this article about groups that, as she puts it, make no metaphysical truth claims, do not focus on God, and offer no promise of an afterlife or reward. And then she continues this way. But they fulfill the functions. So remember, these are groups that don't offer metaphysical truth claims. They don't focus on God. No promise of the afterlife or reward. Typical aspects of a religious ideology. But these groups fulfill the functions that sociologists generally attribute to a religion. They give their members a meaningful account of why the world is the way that it is. They provide them with a sense of purpose and the possibility of sainthood. They offer a sense of community, and they establish clear roles and rituals that allow adherents to feel and act as part of a whole. These aren't just subcultures, Burton says. They are churches. And until we recognize the religious hunger alongside the destructive hatred, we have little chance of stopping these terrorists. Those are the groups she's describing, or ones she identifies as terrorist groups. And she goes on to say this: now more than ever, the promises religion has traditionally made, a meaningful world, a viable place within it, a community to share it with, rituals to render ordinary life sacred, are absent from the public sphere. I'm not going to expand on that, but that's a very important aspect of this. More and more Americans are joining the ranks of the religiously unaffiliated. There are more religious nones than Catholics or evangelicals, and 36% of those, this was, 2019, that number has risen considerably, 36% of those born after 1981 don't identify with any religion. These new reactionary movements, with their power to offer answers at once mollifying and vituperative to the chaos of experience, are one of the ways that Americans are filling that gap, the gap being the absence of religious subcultures offering these things. When we ignore the religious aspect of extremist groups, we allow them to claim the monopoly on meaning. That's not ground I, at least, am willing to cede. Now, interesting to read Burton's perspective on this when, right here in our province, for example, we are often hearing the voices of religious extremity claiming a monopoly on meaning and claiming that the vast majority of people are making meaning around the events of a pandemic, for example, in ways that are not valid. So, right, so there's that intersection. Burton's, that is ground that I, at least, am not willing to cede, is important. And this is one way, I think, to understand or explain why we at the table and outside of there, of course, why we keep on exploring what we believe, why that's a good or necessary compulsion. It's because that ground that Burton is writing about, that ground of meaning making or of finding purposeful, even hopeful ways of living, That's not a space that we are prepared to hand over to what she calls reactive movements. She uses a couple of very telling descriptive words that I want to unpack a little bit before we wrap this up for today. She talks about reactive movements being those that offer answers that are both mollifying and vituperative to the chaos of experience. I don't need to say anything about the chaos of experience. We all have our own knowledge and our own experiences of that to work with. But just a moment with those other two words, mollifying and vituperative. Let's start with some shared definitions. To mollify is to appease the anger or anxiety of someone. To appease the anger or anxiety of someone. So to mollify what Burton calls the chaos of experience is to offer a way to view that chaos that moves it away from feeling like disorder and toward feeling like it has meaning. There's a way to order it and understand it and make meaning of it. Mollifying the chaos of experience isn't about whether something that's being offered is true or untrue, even though that kind of language is often applied in making a case for its believability. It's really about offering people something that works. It's very pragmatic. Something that taps into some part of that person's experience in ways that resonate and that give them that aha moment where what looked like chaos only a moment before now makes some kind of sense. To take a religious example from within the traditions that I grew up closest to, if you were someone who grew up pondering the question of evil in the world, but outside of religious explanations for that, and you encountered the kind of traditional Christian narrative of the fall of humanity, that particular reading of the Garden of Eden story and Adam and Eve and that whole thing, you encountered that story, you might have had this kind of a moment where it was like, oh, there we go. That satisfies my question about why evil exists, why suffering exists in the world. It's a very tidy bundle of explanation for that. So that aha moment, right? Now, we've just been through a whole series and we're still in a whole series about what happens when that story stops making sense, because then you still have the chaos of the question to deal with, or you have it again, right? But that's that aha moment, that's super powerful. And if it dials, in the person's experience, if it dials up meaning and dials down anxiety, that explanation is like a drug. Reality be damned and spare me your logic. This feels right to me. I don't use this expression just as a rhetorical device, I would die for that belief, right? You can have that kind of a powerful encounter with it, with these things. Reality be damned is what I wrote in my notes and what I just said. I want you to hold on to that word reality for a moment and just kind of park it back there. Keep it handy because we're going to come back to it. All right, so that's to mollify. A word we might even, you know, feel aware of or use. This other word felt to me like, good word, but haven't heard that one for a while. Vituperative. To be vituperative is to be uttering or given to censure, containing or characterized by verbal abuse. So censure is, by definition, a judgment involving condemnation. It's to judge something and condemn it. Does that idea of judging involving condemnation, does that strike anyone as familiar in the realm of our current public verbiage? I don't even want to say dialogue because usually it's not. You know, that whole don't like what you see going on around you, doesn't fit with what you believe, judge it, condemn it, dismiss or disregard someone that represents a version of it that doesn't line up with your ideological preferences and be as unkind, rude, and crude in the process as you wish. So I talked about this shared human problem we have with things we believe, which is that we can turn them, right? We can turn them into unhealthy things or even violent and destructive things. One way to sum up the shared problem in all of this is that none of it changes what I'm going to call this morning reality. Here's what I mean by that word in this instance. This is my favorite definition by far so far. This comes from the novelist Philip K. Dick, whose writings, for example, are the background literature behind some pretty well-known Hollywood films such as Blade Runner or The Minority Report, which contains one of my favorite sort of philosophy of reality moments in film, this idea that the precogs are never wrong, but sometimes they disagree when it comes to possible futures. That's Philip K. Dick idea. The Adjustment Bureau would be another one. Anyway, this quote comes from that novelist who defines reality this way. Reality is that which... I know what's coming. It's not fair. Reality is that which, when you stop believing in it, doesn't go away. Reality is that which, when you stop believing in it, doesn't go away. In other words, that which is bigger than whatever beliefs we hold, no matter what those beliefs are. So beliefs that we can hold, reality is still there. We let that belief go, reality is still there. It's bigger than what we believe. When we stop believing in it, it doesn't go away. That's what makes it real. Now, we can live in denial of this, of course. We don't have to accept the definition, right? We have a lot of agency in these things. In fact, it's not that hard to make the argument that in many ways, that's exactly what we have been doing as a species. We've been denying reality. But it's getting harder and harder to say that that's working just fine. Philosopher of religion, Loyal D. Rue, that's Loyal with the initial D, Rue, in a book of his called Religion is Not About God, a fairly compelling title. In that book, Rue puts this same idea this way. He says, the most profound insight in the history of humanity is that we should seek to live in accord with reality. Indeed, living in accord with reality may be accepted as a formal definition of wisdom. And as a philosopher of religion, he's obviously aware of religious wisdom literature and definitely tapping into it with what he says here next. If we live at odds with reality, brackets, foolishly, and that's very much a Proverbs kind of identification of the life of the fool is to live at odds with reality. If we live at odds with reality foolishly, then we will be doomed. But if we live in proper relationship with reality, wisely, then we shall be saved. The most profound insight in the history of humanity is that we should seek to live in accord with reality. Indeed, living in accord with reality may be accepted as a formal definition of wisdom, in that if we live at odds with reality, foolishly, then we will be doomed. But if we live in proper relationship with reality, wisely, then we shall be saved. In connecting that idea to exploring what we believe, the reason for being for the table community, then, and maybe perhaps even more particularly to exploring what we believe in realms most often relegated to religion. Again, my favorite definition of religion comes from its etymology as a word, the definition being religamenting, that religion is about connecting things that have been torn apart. Michael Dowd offers this. He says, if religion is doing its job, it's to help us live in right relationship to what is fundamentally, undeniably, and inescapably real. To put it another way, if we're part of something that might be identified as religious, and that thing we're identified with or practicing is doing what it ought to do, then it's going to help us live in accord with reality, with something so big that even if we don't believe in it, it doesn't go away. It doesn't only exist because we believe in it. So, as we continue to explore what we believe, and as we move into stage four, which is a gorgeously generous stage, I'm going to say, it's important to be bold enough to face reality, even when that practice of facing reality doesn't reduce our anxiety or doesn't give us a platform for judging or dismissing others. It doesn't provide us with those, with mollification or vituperation. Is that a word? Even when that's not what comes from it, it's important to press into it, usually because pressing into that kind of approach brings us face to face with our own fears and our own shortcomings. And facing our own fears and shortcomings, acknowledging them, naming them, owning them, is partly what helps us be kind, what helps us express our beliefs as love, which, as you may recall, if you grew up around the teachings of Jesus, is Jesus' working definition of meaningful faith, which is faith that expresses itself as love. That's the only faith that matters, according to the rabbi. So as we continue to explore, we need to do that in ways that challenge us to move deeper into whatever we believe, whether we want to call it our faith or our spirituality or our belief system or just our kind of happy grab bag of beliefs that we can currently affirm, you know, however we want to identify that collection. That's what we live out of. That's how we decide what we're going to do when things come at us, you know, at 2:15 on a Wednesday, like ordinary life. Those things, if they include pressing into the seeking of reality, facing reality, that work of facing reality is going to inform our own experiences of ourselves and of the world around us in ways that tend to produce kindness, kindness, that tend to produce the desire and the practices that might help us just a little more often and just a little more effectively express whatever we believe as love. That's where we're headed in stage four. That's sort of the summary. Anyway, let me just you know, wrap this up in some way if I can. It's important to take whatever we are learning or wrestling with and to hold it up in whatever ways we can to whatever we can imagine will still be there when we're not, to what I've been calling reality. And to have that experience of holding what we believe or what we're examining by way of beliefs up to reality and have that inform how we think of and how we speak of and how we live out of those learnings. That's the kind of exploration that I believe can bring us together as human beings rather than dividing us even further, and that can help us make things together that are in accord with reality. Ways of living and being that are wise rather than foolish, that are life-affirming rather than life-denying, and that can offer meaning and purpose and belonging for all, not just for some. That's where I'm going to leave that now. In some ways, that's an extended introduction to our exploration of stage four, which, you know, all going according to plan, we will get into next week. And then I'll kind of keep you posted going forward about how we're going to unfold that. But that's where we'll leave it for now. All right. So thanks for walking with me through that extended intro. All right. Peace, everybody.